We've just wrapped up a three-part series on J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. The goal of that series was to look at the known evidence that we have on Hoover to see whether it was likely that Hoover was either a plotter, a person with foreknowledge of the assassination, or someone involved in a cover-up. In this 15th edition of Recap and Rebuttals, we review the key questions that we discussed in episodes 67 through 69 with Don from the Fourth Reich Archaeology Podcast, coming up next on Solving JFK.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
We're joined today by Don from the Fourth Reich Archaeology Podcast. You may also know him on Twitter slash X as the handle Angleton's Orchids. I found out about Don's show, Fourth Reich Archaeology, and quickly learned that Don and his co-host Dick have put together the best deep dive on the background of the Warren Commissioners that exists in podcast form. The series is called The Warren Commission Decided, and it goes in depth on the backstories of the commissioners and the staffers and, you know, talks about the work of the commission. It's an ongoing series as well. I invited Don on the show today because his work on the Warren Commission touches on J. Edgar Hoover's relationship with the commission. And I also think that Don's doing really good work on the show. So, Don, welcome to Solving JFK.
Thank you very much, Matt, for having me. And thank you for inviting me and my little cartoony avatar here onto the show.
Don values his anonymity, and that allows him to speak freely, which we appreciate.
So, knock on wood.
Knock on wood. Right on. Well, Don, you know, I just want to kind of address this out of the gate. The name of your show, Fourth Reich Archaeology. I typically try to avoid politics as much as possible on the show. You know, that gets really hard when you're talking about American history. You know, for example, anytime I bring up anything about, you know, the current president, I get feedback that I'm either very unfair because I have a liberal bias, or that I'm a Trump sycophant. So the reality is I've never really shared my politics, but you know, I'll just say, just for the purpose of this conversation, I'm a libertarian. So coming from that background as a small business lawyer, I'm about as capitalist as you can get. But you know, Don, the thing it sounds like from listening to your show is the real problem you and Dick have is crony capitalism. Certainly, that's the one that I share your frustration with. Basically, where the government is being used to further the goals of oligarchs, effectively. So, at the end of the day, I just want to address the name of the show because I don't want anyone to be turned off from listening to it. Because if you believe in civil liberties, which is a very common belief among those that are interested in the JFK assassination, you're not going to have a problem at all with the host, is my view. You can separate out the politics. And while, you know, Dick and Don do wear their politics on their sleeves and the show to some extent, what's interesting to me is that their study of history and their assessment of kind of how it relates back to today, I believe is absolutely spot on. So you may disagree with some of the politics, but what's interesting is when we're looking at, you may disagree about what to do next, you know, if we're able to get some resolution about these things that happened a long time ago and, you know, still happening today. But I think it's hard to dispute the facts that are laid out on the show. So Don, what can you tell us about the name of the show and sort of your perspective and what you guys are trying to do overall?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, just thanks again, Matt, for having me on. And thanks for the very kind introduction. I think you and I have discussed this off mic, but there's so much common ground that anybody that's really what I would describe as critical of the status quo, that is dissatisfied with the two-party duopoly, as majorities of Americans consistently are, as you can see through opinion polling, that, before carrying a flag for any one or other political movement, I am an independent, do not have a party affiliation. To be clear, Fourth Reich archaeology, we are anti-fascist, let's just say. And where the origins of the project and its name come from is we observe around us a vast gulf between what we are told about America, about the democratic principles that supposedly animate the government and its actions, and the pursuit of liberty and justice for all. And that just contrasts so drastically with the reality that we see where, like you said, we have a kind of oligarchic takeover of the government, dating even back to, the war is a racket, Smedley Butler line, that my entry into politics was really as anti-war activism. And so you see, the more that you look into this, how much our government and even the lives of our service members are being sacrificed at the altar of the profits of these multinational corporations and billionaires, especially powerful today. And so, it's a provocative lens of saying, well, maybe more than a democracy, we're really something more like the Fourth Reich. And there's a very literal aspect to that too, which, I don't know if your show's gotten into it yet. Maybe it will later on. But after World War II, it's better or lesser known, but the United States imported just thousands of high-ranking SS members and Nazi officials into the government, both through Operation Paperclip in the hard sciences, but perhaps even more impactful, in my opinion, into the intelligence services through the Galen organization, which was kept very secret for a very long time, but is now well documented. And the impact that those Nazis had on steering US foreign policy to an extremist form of anti-communism, using some of the very figures that come up here, guys like Hoover or Alan Dulles, a Warren commissioner himself. The goal of our project is to dig into history and figure out how is it that we got here and how is it that we might dig our way out.
Yeah, and when I'm listening to your show, and I've listened to all of the Warren Commission Decided episodes and a couple of the Jerry World episodes. These guys have a whole series where they go super deep on Gerald Ford. It's called Jerry World. Check it out, it's great. And what's fun too is that while I think it's safe to say some of these historical figures, you guys certainly view, like they're the bad guys, kind of sort of. It's also true that like you really do a good job of showing like the texture. I mean, it's really a history show at the end of the day. So and an analysis. So, but what's crazy to me about the Warren Commission Decided episodes, you're going deep on each respective commissioner and then some of the bigger staffers. There are so many connections of these people all knew each other. It's like LBJ said they're going to have, two members of the public and two members of Congress, two members of the House, two members of the Senate. And, it's just interesting how the random people they picked as members of the public were people who all knew each other and they hadn't been out of government too long. So
Yeah.
the connections never end, I guess. The Charlie Day conspiracy board goes on forever and ever.
Yeah. Well, like George Carlin was fond to say, it's one big club and you ain't in it.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Well, let's go ahead and get into the recap and rebuttals portion here of the show. And Don, I'm just going to kind of go through sort of the main points. Not all these are questions. Some of them are just sort of like a review of things we talked about. And then you can sort of chime in whenever you like. Sound good?
Sure thing. I'm
All right.
a long-time listener, so I'm familiar with the format.
Long time listener, first time caller. All right.
Yes, sir.
All right, so Hoover's extremely long tenure at the FBI. Let's start there. I don't think people realize that J. Edgar Hoover was running stuff at the Bureau of Investigation right when it first started. He was involved in some raids on behalf of some basically, I want to say, anti-communist raids that ended up not being well received on
The
behalf of,
Palmer raids.
what was it again?
The Palmer raids. That was
Palmer.
A. Mitchell Palmer was the attorney general at the time.
Yes. Yeah. And so, but basically, he gained favor with the powers that be, which led to him being named director and then director of the new FBI. But this dude was in charge of the BOI and the FBI for 48 years at the top, not like an executive, but at the top for 48 years. He created all the systems. I mean, this guy was the king of the FBI. I thought the fact that he called the FBI the seat of government, like, wow, that's, at first I was like, oh, he's referring to Washington, D.C. No, he's not. He's referring to the FBI building, maybe the, institution, whatever, but he sees himself as the seat of government. Really something. He pursued en enemies of the government, and he did not care at all about civil rights or the First Amendment, not even a little bit. COINTELPRO, he's a gay man going after gay rights groups. It's a different era, so I understand that. But it seems to be the main thing that sort of drove Hoover was being worried about mandatory retirement on his 70th birthday, which was January 1st, 1965. Kennedy, even if he wasn't reelected, would still be in office at that time because it would be, before the inauguration of the next president. So Hoover knew that he needed a presidential exemption to avoid retirement, and it became clear that he would not get one from JFK. And of course, LBJ goes on to provide him this exemption just a few days before he testifies before the Warren Commission. Thoughts on, what motivated Hoover?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit a lot of it, but I would add that with respect to his crusading and the COINTELPRO aspect, that also reflected not only a very deeply held anti-communist belief, but also, Hoover was a pretty avowed white supremacist. He was a member of the Kappa Alpha fraternity in his days at GW, which was very much into Confederacy cosplay and longing for the antebellum South and the good old days of Dixie. And that stayed with him. And in fact, he recruited agents, especially biased towards deep Southerners and guys with Kappa Alpha credentials as well, that, reflects an identity of the FBI that is now pretty well known. But is another thing that even maybe comes into play here. The other aspect that I wanted to point out about Hoover's tenure was Hoover, like you said, his career spanned such a long period of time, dating back to the 19 teens, I think, or maybe the 20s, late teens, early 20s, something like that. But he was, of course, already well established well before the CIA was even a thing. And since he considered himself to be the kind of end of the line for intelligence gathering in the United States, he was pretty opposed to forming a CIA that would encroach on what he saw to be his domain. And he would rather have had the FBI expand than to create a new central intelligence agency. So even at that time, he butted heads with guys like Dulles and McCloy, who had Truman's ear in crafting the CIA's structure back in the late 40s.
Dulles and McCloy, you mean members of the public?
Oh yeah, those two average Joes.
Appointed to the Warren Commission. Yeah. Let's move on to Hoover's relationship with Clyde Tolson. And the only reason I bring this up is because there's a couple of reasons. So Hoover had a long-term monogamous gay relationship with Clyde Tolson. I think that's well documented. I don't think it's disputed at this point. There may be somebody somewhere who says that's not true. But the only reason I bring it up and why it matters is because it almost certainly there was blackmail against Hoover because of it by the mafia. We know Angelo Bruno knew this about Hoover. We know there were rumors that there were photos of them, and you know that never it's never been verified. But the point is, you know, being gay was a very blackmailable thing at the time, so that's worth noting. And then also just back to sort of who Hoover was, you know, he's actively persecuting these gay rights groups even though he's gay, but I get it, he's got to maintain his cover, right? That's part of the whole fact of being blackmailable. So I understand that too. And the other thing is, you know, Hoover had, judging by today's standards, in terms of like, you know, the Me Too conversation about power dynamics, et cetera, you know, Hoover's boyfriend, spouse, partner, was the number two guy in charge of the whole FBI. That's really something.
Oh, yeah.
Really something. This super buttoned up, 'cause it's just crazy to think that like two gay dudes are running the country that's like super like anti-gay at the time. It was just really interesting, you know, realization to have.
Very much so. Yeah.
All right, but that's it on Clyde Tolson. You agree that they're probably, to some extent, there's Hoover's worried about being blackmailed by somebody somewhere on that issue, or do you think he wasn't really worried about it?
Yeah. I mean, I think that he was worried about it. I think that it was an open secret. I mean, he and Clyde were going out to clubs all the time. They were vacationing together, as I think you talked about in your earlier episode. And I wonder what you think about the Gordon Novell accusations. This was the potential CIA employee, Gordon Novell, expert in electronics eavesdropping. He reported that he personally was given copies of compromising pictures of Hoover and Tolson by James Jesus Angleton of the CIA, and that he confronted Hoover with those photos to kind of send a message on behalf of the CIA during the Jim Garrison investigation in the late 60s.
Yeah, I think I put Gordon Novell in a similar category as Richard Case Nagel, and their
Yeah.
names almost rhyme. I think they're definitely CIA connected. There's definitely something going on there, but it's hard to suss out what is disinformation, limited hangout, misinformation. You know what I mean? So I
Totally.
think it's worth listening to and analyzing, but I don't know where you get at the end of the day. So I'm not sure. That very well could be true. I'm not saying it's not true,
Yeah.
that there was a
And
photo.
another point that I wanted to interject on the gay blackmail situation with Hoover is that he was not the only person in the mix of things that had potential sword hanging over his head. LBJ's one of his closest aides, Walter Jenkins, who was allegedly one of LBJ's bag men as well, in sort of collecting potentially illicit donations from donors. He was arrested on a morals charge, whatever the euphemism it was at the time, for getting caught in like a public restroom with another man in 1959. The FBI cleared him after that to work in the White House, so had some awareness of that. And then, of course, in 64, it blows up again, and Hoover and LBJ are on the phone, and in that phone call, you can listen to it on the LBJ library. It was not erased. But Hoover says, and it just goes to the depth of the psychology of this man and his projections onto others, that he's like, this is a desperately sick man, and I think he should be institutionalized. And talking about, locking him up after he got caught. So it underscores to me the degree to which Hoover really was committed to this not getting out beyond what was known.
This psychoanalyzing we'll leave to everybody, but there's definitely some to do there for sure. Let's talk about Hoover's key relationships. And you know, this isn't really a question of, hey, what happened here? What's the disputed issue? It's just more of a like getting context for everything that would happen after the assassination. So with RFK, Bobby Kennedy, RFK Senior, it was a very strained relationship. He hated Bobby Kennedy. A lot of it was powered, I'm sorry, a lot of it was just personal dynamics. RFK was young and entitled, and he wasn't giving Hoover the respect that Hoover felt he deserved. And you know, probably objectively deserved as having been there that long. He wore short sleeve shirts. He would bring his kids to the office. There's the famous time when he left his kids with Hoover, which is hilarious. He forced Hoover to have the hotline installed on his phone. I mean, he really was heavy-handed forcing Hoover to do stuff he didn't want to do. Hoover was used to reporting to the president directly, and RFK wanted to run, the whole DOJ and have the FBI report to him. So that was a problem for Hoover. And then politically, they disagreed. Their two biggest disagreements were about the mafia threat. RFK just viewed it as a sort of a geopolitical threat from countries from Cuba and the Soviet Union. And Hoover viewed it as a more of a McCarthyist, hey, we have to police thought crimes of people who may be, thinking too communistic. Communistic is a word I keep reading, which I wasn't hip to before.
He loved to pronounce it communistic. He didn't do the long U. I don't the communist. There's a communist conspiracy.
Oh, that's nice. Hoover did like that?
Yeah.
That's great. Okay. Okay. So yeah, RFK thought it was more foreign adversaries. And then the biggest thing between them was Hoover didn't agree at all about the mafia. Now, you could say that's because they had blackmail on him or because he was friends with Frank Costello. But RFK wanted to aggressively pursue the mafia as a problem. And you could even argue that he was maybe a little too aggressive. Hoover wanted nothing to do with that. So, people can speculate about why that is and whether there was blackmail or whatever. Anything on the RFK relationship you want to chime in on?
I think I'll save it for when we get to the mafia
Okay.
so that we have it all on the table.
Okay. I can't wait to hear that. JFK, the president. So Hoover disliked JFK, but he did treat him like the president, and he treated JFK better than RFK. Now, he also disagreed with JFK about communism. He thought Kennedy was too soft, and he hated JFK's sexual promiscuity and adultery, especially, affairs that he thought were potential threats to national security. Judith Campbell, who was simultaneously sleeping with the Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana, and Ellen Romesh, who was alleged to be an East German spy, were both people that JFK had hooked up with. So Hoover basically thought that he was acting beneath the office. And Hoover was also against the civil rights movement, which he thought, if you cared about civil rights, that made you a communist. So he didn't like when JFK had Martin Luther King to the White House, and he thought JFK was too friendly to civil rights. So that's really the extent of their relationship. JFK didn't step on Hoover's toes a ton, but Hoover was always sending, evidence of all of the JFK affairs and all these things, basically to remind Bobby Kennedy that, hey, I have this on you. We got some dirt on you if you do anything.
Just on that point, I mean, I think one of the things, and Beverly Gage, who wrote this book, G-Man, I think it was a Pulitzer-winning biography of Hoover, a lot of blank spots for my taste, but it was informative nonetheless. She talks a lot about how Hoover had this obsession over imposters and that he prosecuted and investigated all reported cases of anybody impersonating an FBI agent. And would just rail about anybody that was saying that they were something they're not. And so I think that undergirds both his hatred for JFK and also for MLK, who, again, he was also obsessed with MLK's sexual habits. And besides the fact that I think Hoover just had it out for the Kennedy brothers as members of this Northeastern New England elite establishment that he was not a part of, being, from Washington, D.C., and being really from a government bureaucratic family.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that makes a lot of sense. Moving on to Lyndon Johnson. So Hoover and Johnson were very close friends. You hear these things that, you hear these little anecdotes, but you got to zoom in to figure out what's actually going on here. And they lived across the street from each other for 19 years. Now, catty corner across the street, so not directly across, but one over, but still across the street from each other diagonally for 19 years when LBJ was in Congress and later in the Senate. And then you listen to these phone. Well, actually, it's mostly letters is what I read, but you read these letters, And they both just lay it on so thick. Dear Lyndon, you are so wonderful. I just think you're so great. I owe my whole career to you. Oh, dear Edgar, you are the best. Every day with you is a day of sunshine and rainbows. It's really something. But it kind of did strike me as, wow, these guys both know that they're super powerful, but the other guy they're talking to is they also appreciate that that guy's powerful and can help them, and they just want to keep the other, in their good graces. So it appeared to really be a mutually beneficial relationship, but not one that was because these guys were just friends and they had common interests, because they both saw the other as being, beneficial for their careers. And specifically, LBJ would use Hoover to kill bad stories in the newspapers, especially ones about Billy Sol Estes and Bobby Baker. Cartha DeLoach was the guy that would go and ask questions, intimidate these newspapers to get them to impact the story that they were putting out. So what does that mean about what ultimately happened? That's a different question. That's up for debate. But when we hear Johnson and Hoover talking to each other, the underlying context is that these guys have a deep, deep history. And it's not like, it's not just the words on the phone call. The parenthetical is like, hey, these guys are part of the system. They've been doing this for a while.
Yeah. And DeLoach, of course, goes on to become the FBI's liaison to the Warren Commission. And that's he's another one of these deep Southern good old boys as well from the ranks of the FBI, a very high ranking guy who had all of the trust of Hoover. I'm sure Hoover had his dossier on him too.
Oh, sure. So that's it. So DeLoach, the guy that Hoover would dispatch to do the dirty work for Johnson, was dispatched to be the liaison for the Warren Commission. Oh, okay. Wow. Interesting. Let's move on to the mafia, Hoover's relationship with the mafia. So, see, the problem with this is a lot of this is, we got some FBI reports and we have some, documentation of him being in the same place, but there's nothing that's absolutely concrete. But long story short, he had some close friends in the mafia. It's hard to tell how close, because most of the action was at the Del Charro Hotel every year for 2 weeks every year, for, since 1938. Hoover would go there with Clyde Tolson. He did. He was very close with Frank Costello, a New York mob boss, and he used him as an informant. We talked about how Angelo Bruno, the Philadelphia mob boss, knew that Hoover was gay, per FBI reports. Clint Murchison and Sid Richardson owned the Del Charro Hotel. Lots of key mafia figures that would come through there during the many, many years when Hoover was there at his cabana, not cabana, what do you call it? Oh, it's not
Bungalow.
bungalow. Bungalow. Thank you. Bungalow A. That's it. Including Howard Hughes. So came by. So, but it's just hard to say. This is, I always try to think, what would somebody on the other side say? And they would go, oh, big deal. Big deal. It might be that, but it's hard to tell. Bottom line, Hoover was against pursuing the mafia in the same way that RFK was, and I've got to imagine that caused some conflict. And I think you had something on that.
Yeah, I wanted to point out, I think there's a role here of what you had hinted at when you were talking about RFK, and it dovetails to me their opposing views on anti-communism, where Hoover really saw the number one goal of his organization was to destroy the communist threat against America and to root out communists everywhere. And he had a little of that paranoia as well of seeing communists behind every bush. And the mafia was an anti-communist, like-minded organization in some respects, because the mafia also was helpful at various points in time to the CIA and the FBI in doing things like breaking strikes, in disciplining the labor movement. Of course, as we know now, the mafia got up to its eyeballs into the organized labor movement, pretty much took it over through Hoffa and the Teamsters. And so, where RFK wanted to go after the mob, because in addition to these activities, which I certainly don't condone strike breaking and all of that kind of stuff, but what RFK was concerned about was that besides that, they were killing people, they were doing human trafficking, drug trafficking, all of this crime. And to Hoover, their use value as anti-communist muscle sort of outweighed that. And remember, I think there's also kind of a sources and methods angle as well. Like when Bobby Kennedy was prosecuting the mob, like you said, some people have said too aggressively because he was illegally wiretapping people. He was really taking the gloves off in turning informants, in getting cases against these people. And the mafia was well funded, so they had pretty good lawyers that could get some of this stuff exposed and to get some bad law in the book. So it's not until 1967 that the Supreme Court finally does ban warrantless wiretapping. Well, we can debate whether that is still the law, but the fact is that Hoover is more interested in sitting on top of this pyramid and just sucking up all the information so that he can oversee his kingdom, whereas Bobby Kennedy was a more of a crusader mentality. He wanted to go in there and stop the criminal activity.
You know, I think RFK had some good things going there. It's easy to look back at history and go, this is my hero, this is my guy, I'm gonna cheer for him and tell everybody how great he was. And sometimes we find that people who we still think are our heroes may have, you know, not made the best decisions at the moment. That's all. So
Yeah, I mean, I have family who was in the Justice Department back in the Kennedy administration that I've asked about this, and they also expressed some real misgivings about the degree to which he did not feel constrained by the Constitution in executing his duties. Let's just put it that way.
this episode of Solving JFK is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help you when you need it, so your dollar goes a long way. Visit progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations.
Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount.
Sure. All right, let's move on to Hoover's failure to provide information about mafia threats. And the reason I bring this up as its own thing is that one of the books I read to prepare for this series was called Act of Treason by this guy named Mark North. And his argument is, look, Hoover found out about these mafia threats. He knew from a an informant who was at a restaurant that was like a Carlos Marcelo controlled restaurant, which is like very loose. What does that even mean? Carlos Marcelo controlled restaurant. Anyway, that there was going to be a hit on JFK and it would be in the South before 1964. Now, what's interesting about that one is there's the whole thing about it sounds like David Ferry may have been there talking about it, but it's got some level of specificity in the South before 64. And then there's the bigger one, which is an informant who his name's Jose Alamon, I believe, who overheard Santo Traficante say that Kennedy was going to be hit before his reelection. So I think certainly the Traficante threat and to some extent the Marcelo one, they should have at least been passed on to Secret Service or to RFK, especially when Hoover's sending every single, you know, tabloid article about anything salacious with the Kennedys onto RFK. You would think he could just forward this. Hey, they may kill your brother. But the counter argument would be this wasn't guaranteed. He didn't know for sure it was going to happen, yada, 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 et cetera. So I don't know. I've struggled, to be honest with you, to find the underlying documents for these reports. So there's a site, but the RIF number I couldn't get to pull up. So I don't know. I ultimately think Hoover should have turned this information over, but it's all a little bit cloudy, and I certainly don't think it's enough to prove like that he's a plotter in any way. That fact. But your thoughts?
Yeah, I don't think that it's enough to prove that he's a plotter. I think, you know, and this is also a little bit of where my current thinking is on LBJ too, of maybe they're aware, because you look at the news reports from the time, like you kind of immerse yourself in 1963 and the real visceral hatred for Kennedy and the divisiveness in the society at large and the possibility of a potential big event like a presidential assassination, it was really part of the ambiance, I think. And so for Hoover to bury these reports, I think I do read a little intentionality into that, just for the reasons that you said. Like, it's not as though he's not escalating other stuff. I also agree with your complaints that it's just the documents are not quite telling on a real narrative that you can hang your head on. But, you know, I also wonder at this point if Hoover isn't scratching his head and wondering what's going on over at the CIA, because he, I believe, would have known about the CIA's use of the mafia in the plots to kill Castro, because just his informant network within the mafia overlapped so substantially with the guys that, you know, through Bob Mayhew and Johnny Rosselli and Santos Traficante were having these discussions. And so he might have just had some confidential, undocumented conversations with his good pal Jim Angleton and figured the lay of the land that way. Or maybe he just kept his mouth shut and waited to see what would happen.
Yeah, that's an important point that I didn't raise, the relationship between Hoover and Angleton. Can you comment on that real quick?
I mean, as I understand it, Hoover, he did have this very fraught relationship with the CIA from the get-go, but it warmed up as more former FBI men made their way into the ranks of the CIA, some of whom were on good paper with Hoover, some of whom weren't. The one person that really jumps out in the Kennedy stuff, of course, is William King Harvey, who was an FBI agent before he jumped over to the CIA, where he ran the assassinations program, or at least played a substantial leadership role in it. And the relationship that Hoover had to the CIA was largely mediated through Jim Angleton, head of counterintelligence for the CIA, and I believe Sam Papich was a Hoover's underling that was like the official liaison to Angleton, and they were talking all the time because they shared a passion for reading people's mail
Yeah.
Morley's book on Angleton, The Ghost, it talks about how the CIA, through Angleton's counterintelligence office, was very frequently discussing the mail opening program under the Lingual, I think it was called.
Lingual, yep.
And so the FBI was in the know on that, and all of these networks is a constant thing that I have to tell my friends I talk to about this stuff that are like, well, where's the smoking gun in the documents? These people were friends. They didn't necessarily document every conversation that they had.
Yeah, that makes it tough because you're like, well, of course they didn't say that. They, you know, they knew each other all these years. All right, let's move on to Oswald as an FBI informant. And where I land on this is I think that Oswald probably was an FBI informant, but I think that the way we're defining the term FBI informant is less exciting than we would we understand it to be. That's kind of what I've learned. It's a super hipster view of like, hey, it's not the thing, but it ends up being the thing. You know what I mean? So Hoover knew about Oswald being impersonated in the U.S. when he was in the Soviet Union. He wrote a memo about it in June of 1960 about Oswald being impersonated. Hoover ordered the FBI to interview Oswald when he returned in May of 1962. This is when, so again, Hoover personally is ordering agents in Dallas, hey, keep an eye on this guy. He's coming back from the Soviet Union. So Hoover knows about Oswald. Anyway, he orders agent John Fain to go visit Oswald and debrief him. Then Fain interviews Oswald two more times before closing Oswald's file when he retires. But they kept the file open on Marina as a Soviet citizen, just to keep an eye on her. It was such that they were going to check back up on her in another 6 months. Oswald told Fain at that time, during the, you know, the debriefing visit, basically, that he would let the FBI know if the Soviets contacted him. And so that right there, just that mere fact that's been reported by Fain, which is, hey, he said he would let us know if the Soviets contact them, that's enough to make him a potential security informant right there. So he could be a security informant just merely about the fact of, hey, if the Soviets contact you, you're going to let us know. That would fit the definition of it. But so after that, after Fain, the Fain interviews, Agent Hostie gets the case when Fain retires. He goes to follow up with Marina 6 months later, but he decides that he heard they had been fighting, and he decides that he's going to wait to go talk to her, which I always thought was weird. It's like, you heard they had been fighting. You're in the government. You're going to be like, I don't know. They got into an argument. I wouldn't want to exacerbate problems in their marriage. Like, what are you talking about? You're the feds. Like, you're here to crush and destroy. Just kidding, feds. You're here to help us. Anyway, sorry. Again, I'm a libertarian. But at any rate, at this time, when Hostie goes to check back on Marina and doesn't end up doing it, he finds out that Oswald is subscribing to, I forget if it's the Daily Worker or the other one, I think it's a Daily Worker that Hostie finds out about at this point. He opens a file on Oswald because of the newspapers he's getting. So after that, Hostie loses track on the Oswalds because they're in New Orleans and he's a Dallas agent. But it's still, man, reading this in the era we're in now and just thinking back to, oh, you know, hey, we have all this mass surveillance, et cetera, now. And then thinking back to the 60s, they didn't care at all about civil, like, they didn't care at all. They were going to put this guy on a list because of a magazine. That really, I mean, I guess people are like, what are you, naive about history? But man, I just found that to be really striking. So anyway, on November 5th, so we're talking about the FBI's relationship with Oswald. On November 5th, 63, just a few weeks before the assassination, Hostie found out that Marina was staying with Ruth Payne, and she stops by Ruth Payne's house to visit. This then leads to the Hostie note, which quickly, that is, you know, this whole famous Hostie note. Oswald goes by the FBI office and in Dallas, and he leaves a note for Hostie, who's not in. And depending on, you know, who you talk to, it's the note says something different. If you believe Hostie, he said, you know, I will take action if you don't leave my wife alone. If you believe the receptionist who took the note from Oswald, it said that he would blow up the FBI and the Dallas police if they didn't leave Marina alone. Of course, this note was then ordered to be destroyed by Gordon Shanklin, the special agent in charge of the FBI Dallas office, which Shanklin denied, but this is what Hostie said happened. And I think it's pretty well established that that is what happened at this point. And the question is, why flush it down the toilet? But if it said blow up the FBI, I'm going to blow up the FBI and the Dallas police. And then you read that and he didn't report that, then that's a real problem for the FBI. So I tend to believe the secretary just based on the facts. I mean, your thoughts on any of that stuff I've talked about so far?
Yeah. First, I think one of the most interesting aspects of this whole informant, whether Oswald is an FBI informant controversy, is that discussion that you made reference to in your episode about when Dulles is saying, essentially, I know that we would just deny it if it was our guy, so I'm sure Hoover would just do the same thing.
Right.
And he never thought that comment would be made public or paid attention to by anyone when he made it. And that's just such a great, candid look into the mentality of these people, and goes back to what we were saying before about lack of documentation or the ability to lie through stuff. I don't think that Oswald was like working hand in glove with the FBI. It just doesn't seem like his activities bear that out. So I kind of agree with, your take that it's a potential, like he probably was working with them in some capacity, but it wasn't so, it wasn't operational. It wasn't like he's working for the FBI to do something in particular. I think it seems to me that that's more on the CIA side of things.
Yeah, right. Yes, that's my assessment. But just looking at, it's a big question. Was Oswald an FBI informant? Well, Don, there's FBI wrote a memo and they said no. So I that seems dispositive, doesn't it? I mean, they said no. Oh, there's the whole thing about they would say no even if the answer was yes. So I guess we have to consider that. Okay, so the FBI wrote a memo and they say no. So I want to get that out of the way. The FBI expressly says that he was not an informant. We have William. Go ahead.
They said the same thing about Jack Ruby as well, which actually more certainty than Oswald turned out to be a lie.
Right.
Because he was contacted at least 9 times by the FBI on record.
Yes. So in other words, what the FBI says in some cases is not worth the paper it's written on, right? If that's in the best interest of the Bureau. William Walter, this New Orleans FBI clerk, he says that Oswald was an informant because he looked through the file before the agent went to go visit Oswald in jail in New Orleans. There were potential security informant numbers. It was a potential security informant type file, which, by the way, is consistent with the John Fain story. Carver Gayton, a former FBI agent, says that Hostie told him the same thing, that he was trying to reopen a file for Oswald as a potential security informant, but he couldn't find Oswald. Then we have the whole Oswald being seen with Bannister in New Orleans. And remember, Bannister is the former special agent in charge of the FBI Chicago office, who was able to easily get Hoover on the phone. And then, Oswald asking to talk to the FBI after he's arrested and then providing the phone number to call the FBI. Mm. So I think that's the strongest counterpoint to, oh, he's just a potential security informant. There's nothing at all going on. The counterpoint would be, well, man, what do you think? What's he calling the FBI about? And I know we can go look, and Quigley, I believe, is the guy he talked to, and Quigley's statement's like, he just wanted to know what the weather was in New Orleans for the next 10 days. And, it was like, meaning it's like clearly whatever Quigley says isn't what really happened, but who knows what actually happened there.
Yeah. And again, raises questions about FBI CIA dynamics, because Bannister is another one of these guys who left the FBI and then is reportedly working for the CIA in New Orleans in the Cuban with the Cubans. So it's if Oswald was infiltrating the Fair Play for Cuba committee in some respect with the involvement of the CIA, then part of that goal of building up a paper trail contacting the FBI could be pursuant to that in some respect. It's more questions than answers as I see it, but it's definitely an interesting aspect. And it certainly, if we can say one thing for sure, it's that there's a lot more than meets the eye with respect to Oswald and his government work.
Yes, I think so. I read the James Gale report, which is he's the guy Hoover tasked James Gale with looking into the FBI's handling of the JFK assassination and figuring out, you know, did they do anything wrong? And in that report, I'm sorry, not in that report, when Gale was interviewed by the HSCA, he said that the FBI sometimes had vest pocket informants, meaning informal informants who were not in the official system. So, wow. I mean, if that's the case, that throws everything into question. I mean, back to the CIA having a heart attack gun. It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, it's a car accident, but there's a heart attack gun. What do you want me to do? So that's basically the conclusion on was Oswald an informant? Probably some sort of relationship. Hard to tell exactly what it was. It probably wasn't nothing. I think that's my conclusion. Marvin Giesling, one of the biggest names in the case for me. One of the when I talk to somebody that doesn't know anything about the case, I feel like this Marvin Giesling fact goes in my top 10 facts. And a lot of things like that I look at once I do a deeper dive on. And the salacious details end up not being as salacious, and it ends up being a closer call. Marvin Giesling is not that. Mm-hmm. Marvin Giesling, when I look into the details, I go, oh my God, this is so shady. There's something happening here, and it's definitely not what you're saying. So let's quickly recap Marvin Giesling. This is the guy who initially put an FBI flash on Oswald. And again, the whole thing of a flash is, it would require the FBI's espionage division to be alerted anytime the FBI receives any documents on Oswald, any files on Oswald. The espionage division's alerted, which means that it would also trigger Oswald being on the security index, which means it would have gone to the Secret Service's Protective Research Service, the PRS. In Dallas, where the rubber hits the road, Oswald would not have been on that route when, you know, Winston Lawson or whoever it was went to ask the PRS if there are any threats. Oswald's name should have popped up on the security index. That's how it should have worked if the alarm was not turned off. So that's why this whole conversation matters so much. And again, just getting to the end before we talk about the whole thing. If Oswald's not there, then if you're a lone nut proponent, then you know, he's not there to kill the president. And if Oswald is not there, you know, if you're a conspiracy proponent, then he's not there to be framed to be the patsy. So this matters either way. But anyway, Giesling is the one that initially puts the flash on Oswald when he goes over to the Soviet Union in 1959 after his attempted defection. And then this is where it gets interesting. On October 9th, Giesling turns off the flash, October 9th, 1963. So he turns it on almost 4 years earlier, turns the flash off on October 9th, 1963. The next day, there's a memo from the CIA in Mexico City talking about how Oswald visited the Soviet embassy. And again, everything I just talked about, that would have been triggered but for Giesling turning the flash off. You know, this memo would have been enough to make Oswald not be on the motorcade route that day, assuming Winston Lawson didn't then go to some other extra shenanigans of like losing the name on the way from the PR. Yeah, the PRS gave it to me and a dog ate my list of names and I didn't know. Okay, I'm just trying to do my best here to protect the country. Anyway, So they turn off the flash. So what's Giesling's defense? And this is when you get into the super deep dive, there's always a counterpoint to the counter and a reply and a surreply, and it just keeps going and going and going. And Giesling's defense is, well, I really should have turned it off when Oswald came back in the country in 1962, but I forgot to do that. But then the reason I turned it off on October 9th is because I remembered that Oswald was arrested in August, and I should have turned it off then. But none of that makes any sense, because if he's arrested, then you don't turn it off. That's a reason to leave it on. And also, the biggest thing is Giesling signed off in August on a document continuing the flash right after Oswald's arrest. So I just think it's beyond, his story is not believable at all. And either the best defense of Gisling is from Bill Simpich, which is that, and he's not trying to defend Gisling, he's just sort of making arguments, but Simpich says that, look, Gisling very well could have realized that Oswald was some sort of FBI informant or working with the FBI somehow and unilaterally taken him off on a coincidental date. But, you know, again, that would show he's an informant, and that's just speculation. Other than that argument, I'm not aware of any arguments that support what Giesling's saying or bolster his point. He still has not explained satisfactorily why he turned the alarm off the day before it would have gone, you know, it would have rang the alarm bell.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I think his defense has no credibility. It's I don't know if you've ever done any criminal defense work, but there's a phrase, testa lying, that is often used to refer to when cops or federal agents will just take the stand and say whatever story they want to say, as long as that thin blue line of silence surrounds and protects them from the consequences. And if there's, he must have had some confidence. I mean, I guess we could see. I've always suspected that maybe this is another opportunity for CIA to have intervened, because they were aware, obviously, of the Mexico City trip that was ongoing at the time. So that's something, that's a record that could have been documented. That's not to say that it necessarily would have been, but as far as this being a big oopsie, the timing, and just like you said, the nonsensicality of the alibi, it doesn't add up for me.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's probably the biggest thing to remember from this section is Gisling. Aside from the other things we're about to talk about, we're getting into sort of the end of the show where we play all the hit songs. All right, so here we go. We're not going to do an encore, though. The November 23rd Hoover-Johnson call. Man, this one to me, this is another one of those top 10 facts overall. And I think when you're trying to decode where is Hoover's head on things and what's his mindset, this call is really a window into that. Okay. Hoover tells LBJ about Oswald being impersonated in Mexico City during this call. We've talked about that. Hoover also says on the same call that the evidence against Oswald is not very, very strong. Again, this is the Saturday after the assassination. Oswald's in custody. It's before Ruby kills him. Now, the fact of this transcript plus Hoover's later memos proves that he knew Oswald was impersonated and the CIA was behind it. So that's a proven fact in my view. And in terms of Hoover knowing this about Mexico City. And he also knew that he was covering up a murder based on this phone call. I mean, I think this phone call, Hoover knowing everything he knows, he's basically saying, look, the CIA is behind Oswald as an imposter in Mexico City, which is the same thing as saying Oswald can't be a lone nut. There's something else going on. Lone nuts are not impersonated going to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. Like, come on. Mm-hmm. So, and then on top of that, the tape being destroyed, that's interesting. Rex Bradford's a hero in my view. He did some really good work. I've met that guy a couple times, and I don't think I ever associated that he was the guy that did this. So Rex Bradford, if you're out there, next time I see you, man, I'll shake your hand, sir. Appreciate your work. So Bradford worked with the LBJ library to try to get the tape, and he gets the tape, and there's 12 other calls on it, 12 calls total, 11 calls sound great, no problems. The second call on the tape is this 14-minute blank, and it's, you know, like every 6 seconds is like a hiccup of a bleh, bleh. So I said, kill him. No, I'm just kidding. That's not in there. anyway, my big question on that, on the tape itself, as opposed to the substance of the conversation, is the tape being erased, and it was intentionally erased, which is an important fact. Does that suggest, hey, this transcript, it's all right here, and wow, this is a spicy transcript. Like, they were worried about it. They erased the tape. Or are we just looking at a partial transcript, and perhaps the tape is the transcript plus other things that we're not privy to? And I suppose you could read the transcript and time it. I haven't done that exercise to see like how much would be missing, but what are your thoughts on all that information that I just threw out there?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly is consistent with consciousness of guilt that it was deliberately deleted. Like, if the transcript were complete and accurate recording of what's on the tape, then I don't get what's the point of destroying the recording.
Unless they didn't know, unless the person destroying it didn't know there was a transcript. That's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah, I suppose that would be the only plausible explanation that would suggest, that would support the view that the transcript is complete.
Yes. But even if it's something else that was hidden from us and we don't know what it is, that's nefarious. That should not get the presumption of innocence. And if it's nothing and the transcript is whole, that's a big deal, because it kind of points to somebody thought it was important enough to delete. And here we have Hoover talking about Oswald being impersonated in Mexico City and the case against him not being very, very strong.
Yeah. And it's especially, I don't want to get too far ahead if you're talking about this later, but the comparing that discussion about Oswald in Mexico City with the subsequent Hoover Johnson calls, yes, where they're talking about Mexico City. And there Hoover is talking about this fellow Oswald, if it was him, or maybe it's not him, receiving money from the, this was based on a CIA connected eyewitness report that a Cuban official handed Oswald a bunch of money in Mexico City.
The Alvarado story, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Now you're there's a recording of that tape of Hoover talking to LBJ about the Alvarado.
Yeah, I believe that was in the November 29th call.
Okay, it's on that one. All right.
That's the long one.
Okay, I know it is on there. It's the one where Hoover's talking to LBJ about the Warren Commission itself.
Mm-hmm.
I have a little clip of that one. But yes, okay. All right, let's move on to the Katzenbach memo. Man, I remember when I first heard of Katzenbach, I was like, who is this just deep state bad guy? And then I look at Katzenbach now and I'm just like, you careerist institutionalist. Like, I'm just like, I don't know. It's a little bit more cloudy than I wanted it to be. So let's talk about the Katzenbach memo. So Deputy AG Katzenbach laid out the game plan on Sunday night, November 24th. And what's key here is his memo, which that's the kind of the document that's saying, here's the direction we're going to go. Here's what we're doing. It's just hours after Ruby kills Oswald. And that's central to everything. And this seems to be when Hoover's perspective changed, too. So Katzenbach writes this after having spoken with Johnson and Hoover on the phone. So they're all aligned when he writes this. And the relevant parts here, the public must be satisfied that Oswald was the assassin, that he did not have Confederates who are still at large, and that the evidence was such that he would have been convicted at trial. And, you know, this memo, I think, is absolute proof that there was no objective investigation. I mean, this is 2 days later after now Oswald's gone, and it's the blueprint for the investigation that was done by the FBI and for the Warren Commission. Hoover's directives to the FBI were all in line with this memo after it was written. And the agents were told to only pursue leads on Oswald and not any other angles. In terms of Katzenbach and what's he doing, what's his angle, what's his position, he's an RFK loyalist. You know, wouldn't you think that he would want a full investigation? Was sort of my question. If he's really an RFK, how much of an RFK loyalist can he be and then write this memo that is, you know, focused solely at Oswald and is not focused on an objective investigation? And the only thing I can, you know, my educated guess on what Katzenbach was thinking is that, you know, he's an institutionalist, he's a careerist, And he cares about the United States, how we're perceived abroad, especially in the Cold War, And, you know, he's aware of all these things that are being said about, you know, right-wing conspiracies and in the press. And he just wants to put the kibosh on that because of, I guess, national security or international embarrassment, whatever it is. And it's funny, like me as such an anti-institutionalist, well, I'm really telling everybody what I really think now. But as someone who's not an institutionalist at all, it's hard to believe that someone could care about any institution that much, but I suppose maybe it's possible. It's a different time and different person. What are your thoughts?
So when we covered the Katzenbach memo, you know, I looked into, as with as much as we can on anybody that we're assessing their role, into his background and family background. And when you scratch the surface on Katzenbach, you know, I think he's not only an institutionalist and a careerist, he is really one of these blue-blooded Yankee types that has his pedigree in the American upper echelons of society, the power elite, right, as C. Wright Mills called it. His ancestors were in the Revolutionary War with Casimir Pulaski on his mother's side. His father was the Attorney General of the state of New Jersey. His wife was from the Phelps Dodge family, of the Phelps Dodge mining interests, mm-hmm. that also have their own little fingerprints elsewhere in JFK world. And, you know, this, he went to boarding school at Phillips Exeter. He went to Princeton and then went to Yale Law School. And so I think there's a whole other level of institutionalism that is beyond what, as like a, you know, not a person with that pedigree, beyond what's even accessible to imagine from my perspective. But I think that he really did feel this sense of belonging to an elite that saw itself as the safeguards for the national interest on like a massively longer time scale than what most short-term political actors think on. And in that same approach, you mentioned that he had already talked with Hoover and with LBJ, but what we also discovered or you know, focused on and our excavation into the formation of the Warren Commission was, on the day of Ruby killing Oswald, Katzenbach spoke with Eugene Rostow three times before Rostow called up LBJ's aide Bill Moyers to advocate for forming a presidential commission. And right. Eugene Rostow was also, like Katzenbach, was editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal. So he was the dean of Yale Law School at the time. He told Moyers he was with a party here, and that they were, he didn't say who was there, but you could assume his brother Walt Rostow, who's a Vietnam War hawk and a member of Kennedy's National Security Council staff at the time, a really hawkish guy. I mean, a nuclear first strike advocate type of a guy, who was in the OSS, as were, you know, Dulles, Angleton, Helms, and company. There's good reason to believe that they're also coordinating with the likes of Dean Acheson and Joe Alsup, this brain trust, this real elite behind the, like, power behind the throne. We called them a spooked up Bene Gesserit, if any of your listeners are Dune fans out there. But this very kind of insular club that Katzenbach, you know, he represented maybe the best elements of that club, because like you said, you know, and he would have known the potential for violence, because just earlier in, I don't know if it was the same year, but he was on the ground in the University of Mississippi, and I think at Alabama too, when they were integrating. Ironically, he was there when Edwin Walker started a race riot to prevent the integration of Ole Miss. Right. So it could have been that he viscerally felt the very real possibility that things could really get out of control very quickly if the, like you said, if the kibosh were not put on the clean story. As Eugene Rostow put it to Bill Morris, when you have the bastard dead, you know, the whole landscape changes. And I right. think everybody breathed a big sigh of relief when Oswald got sure. got.
For sure. All right, let's talk about the shooting scrape little statement. This is a small thing, and maybe this should have gone in the LBJ section, but good God, I got plenty for the LBJ section, trust me. In a call with Hoover, 3 days after the assassination, Johnson, they're talking about trying to avoid a presidential commission, and how what Johnson wanted to do is just have Hoover put out his FBI report, which Johnson, by the way, wanted like 3 days after the, he wanted it by like the Wednesday after the assassination. He's like, we buried him yesterday, but give me the report today. Let's be done with this. And you know, it took the FBI a while or whatever. So they got their report out, said Oswald did it alone, obviously had a bunch of holes in it. And then he wanted Wagner Carr simultaneously, his guy in Texas, to do his own thing, his own investigation, which would be coordinated with the FBI. That's what Hoover wanted. I mean, what LBJ wanted. But like you were saying, Rostow and some other folks, you know, kind of to your point, through the newspaper editorials, basically, they advocated for this presidential commission. And this phone call where LBJ is talking about the shooting scrapes, he's really talking about, hey, there's this, you know, another opinion piece is going to come out in the Washington Post. There's already one in the New York Times, and they're calling for this commission. And I don't want it to be inside the White House. I just want, you did yours, we're done, right? And then Johnson says that he can't be looking into every shooting scrape in the country. Like, that's how he describes the murder of his predecessor 3 days earlier. I can't be looking into every shooting scrape in the country. Like, whoa. So he didn't feel bad at all. Anybody who wants to take the official story position of Johnson felt bad and he was trying to do a good job. No. This guy's, let's say he's not involved. I'm not taking a position on Johnson's involvement, but Johnson's, it's hard to look at this and not see Johnson as kind of a monster. In terms of the shooting scrapes conversation.
Yeah, pretty heartless. I mean, it's the same heartless than when Hoover called Bobby Kennedy right after and was like, the president has been shot, we're monitoring the situation, talk to you later, and then like hangs up the phone.
Uh-huh. Right, exactly. All right, so last question, and we'll get to a few rebuttals real quick. Hoover's ultimate role. So, you know, and I've talked about this, but was he a plotter in JFK's murder? My position is no. What's your position?
I tend to agree. I don't think that he had any, no, I don't think he had any operational role in plotting the assassination.
Did he have foreknowledge of the assassination? I land on inconclusive. On one hand, we don't have proof, and that's, I'm in the game of like saying, what can we prove, not what can we speculate about, because there's just so much we could speculate about. So there's no proof, but at the same time, there is opportunity given the Del Charo connection. He's there every year for 2 weeks every year. I mean, I don't know if you know anybody listening has a situation where you go somewhere the same place every year. I go out to my parents' lake house every year. You go there for, and if you're there for a little bit of time, you get to know people there. You get to know, you know, especially as it's recurring. So 2 weeks, I mean, who knows what happened? It's really hard to say. So I wouldn't rule it out that he knew somehow, you know, or maybe had a sense that maybe it would be happening, but we have no proof at all that he had foreknowledge from a proof standpoint. All right. Was he involved in the cover-up? So this is where I say yes. And the main reason that makes me say yes is how he just let go of the Mexico City angle after the Katzenbach memo was put out, and how on Saturday he goes, oh, it's not very, very strong, the evidence against Oswald. There's no new piece of evidence that comes in between Saturday and Monday, I believe it is. Yeah, Saturday and Monday when he changes his tune. And so To me, Hoover had to have known that he was involved in a cover-up, given that he just dropped the Mexico City thing. That's the biggest indicator to me. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty strong case that he willingly participated in a cover-up, because it's not the only case that we know that Hoover covered up. There's other examples, including doing favors for President Johnson, both right. before and after he became president, that were, real quid pro quo type of arrangements, scratching your back and you scratch mine. And I think that, for me, that tilts towards implying that he probably had a general foreknowledge, but I don't know that it was specific to Dallas on such and such a date, but rather if he, let's just put it this way. I don't think that he was surprised when he heard the news. And I think that he had already a few ideas about different possible of his frenemies that might have some information
right.
on it.
Right. Yes. Right.
And in doing the cover up, I think he probably was keen to also collect all of the information that he could on the side, while steering the investigation away from those minefields that could blow up in the FBI's face.
Do you think he knew what happened, or do you think he just knew that he needed to cover up the investigation to avoid nuclear war? I don't believe that he fell for the nuclear war lie was for Earl Warren and Dick Russell. I think Hoover is a level above that, and he knows. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I don't think he would have cared that much. I mean,
he'd have been like, good.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Hey. First strike, that's pretty wild stuff. All right, so let's get to rebuttals. I have these at the end. I got three rebuttals. Real quick, the first one, this was raised on X from Mark Mathijs Kattenberg, and basically he just said, are you going to talk about Hostie's notes from Oswald's interrogation where Oswald says that he was outside when the president was shot? So I did not bring that up, but that's true. There are these handwritten notes from Hostie where he's interviewing Oswald. And by the way, this is in Malcolm Blunt's collection. I don't know if it's available anywhere else, but the distinguished author, I'm sorry, I don't know if he's written any books, but he's one of the best researchers that has some of the best stuff, Malcolm Blunt. It's in his archives. And basically, let's see, what does it say? I have it right here in front of me. Oswald stated he was present for work at the school book depository in the morning of 11:22, and at noon he went to lunch. He went to second floor to get a Coca-Cola to eat with lunch and returned to the first floor to get lunch or to eat lunch, then went outside to watch the parade. So this all comes into the Bart Camp's prayer man theory. Are you hip to that?
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
You know the picture of everybody on the front of the steps, and there's the guy, and everyone goes, "Oh, that's Oswald," and it's Billy Lovelady. That's the that thing leads to. Okay, there's another guy next to Billy Lovelady who's got his hands like this, like on his head, really, or maybe his hand is like this. Okay, or maybe I may be thinking wrong. Maybe he's got his hands like this, but he's got his hands in a way that people were like, "Oh, he's like it's like he's saying a prayer or something." Okay, they call him Prayer Man. Okay, that person has never been identified. And it kind of looks like Oswald. Okay. Mm. What Bart Camp did is he went through and he listed out and inventoried every single person who was present at the school book depository and what their statement was of where they said they were. And he's able to account for every single person except for Prayer Man and Oswald. Back to this Hostie statement that's being raised. If Hostie wrote down the day of the assassination that Oswald said that he went outside, that's consistent with the Prayer Man story. And also, you know, this whole famous thing, it's in the movie JFK and Oliver Stone's great, trying to get him on the show soon. The famous lore is that Oswald ran into Marion Baker on the second floor with Truly, and he's got a Coke in his hand. But if you look at Marion Baker's affidavit from the same day, it's the first floor it's the third or fourth floor that he runs into somebody. So again, this is back to, Oswald very well may not have had that famous interaction with Baker on the second floor, because it's not consistent with Baker's affidavit. Although when Baker testified to the Warren Commission, that's the famous story we all know. He does tell that story. So I don't know. It's, how do I view that? I think it's important. And I think Oswald's not on the sixth floor for other reasons that I've laid out in this book over my shoulder. So that all makes a lot of sense to me. That very well could be him as prayer man. It's not Billy, because the haters, Don, will go, that's Billy Lovelady. I understand your Billy Lovelady argument. That's not what we're saying. We're talking about something else. Okay. your thoughts on that? Anything?
I'll have to look at the, take a closer look at the picture and see, but I mean, it seems plausible, and it also just reminds the point one more time that is very well known, but it's also on the FBI as well as the Dallas police, because it points out that Hostie was in the interrogation room and he knew that there was no audio transcription or stenographic transcription taken of the interrogations of Oswald, which again, it's like beyond absurd to me to say, oh, well, they weren't widely available. There were newsmen all over the place. You just go outside and get somebody's tape recorder. That is like beyond the pale. And it would be helpful if we had that record to compare Hostie's handwritten marginalia there and hear the witness himself, Oswald himself, to describe his whereabouts. And we'll never have that.
I just want to recognize you for saying marginalia. Not many people are using that word that much anymore. So I've used it a few times, and I think it's really, that's what it is when you write in the margins, and Hoover liked to do it all the time.
It's one of the things that makes reading these documents from the FBI so difficult too, because a lot of it is handwritten margin notes, and I'm not that good at reading those.
Yeah, right.
Kick and scratch.
Let's go to the next rebuttal. Richard Case Nagel's letter to the FBI. So Richard Case Nagel, I covered him in the Foreknowledge episode, and where I landed on Richard Case Nagel is that I don't agree with Fred Litwin that he's a total nothing burger crazy person, but it's not established to me that he's always telling the truth, because there's not evidence. We're really just relying on his word, but the big smoking gun in Nagel's favor is that he has the name of seven active CIA assets, agents, something, folks who are working for the CIA, written on his notebook. And then there's this memo saying, I don't know how he got this. I don't know what's going on. I also talked to John Newman, who I know he's kind of all over the place and what he's saying sometimes, because he just knows so much. So it's hard for him to keep it on track. But Newman believes that Nagel was CIA, and that you just can't believe every single thing he's saying. But he definitely wasn't just some crazy guy pretending to be CIA. He was something with him. So, Nagel says he sent this letter to the FBI, basically, warning them in advance in a registered letter. He doesn't have any proof of it. The FBI says they never got it. So it's a he said, FBI said situation. And nothing really changes for me on the Nagel side of things, just because, I think he is somebody to not be ignored, but I just have no clue what's true and what's not true. So that's where I'm at.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think it really is hard to swallow the pill that he talked about having the receipt of that was, signed for by the FBI for his registered letter to Hoover, and just didn't ever put up with it. He never gave it to Dick Russell. He never gave it to anybody. Yeah. And it's like that, for all that he talks about being able to document everything, like that is hard to overlook. I also agree that, and it's another case of a guy who maybe had his mind scrambled, because he did have this hospitalization history.
Right.
brain injuries and stuff like that. So it's possible that, anything could really be going on with him.
No, it's for sure. Okay, last one, and this is just a little housekeeping one. This is from my friend, fellow JFK podcaster, Jeff Crudell, JFK, The Enduring Secret. He's been going deep on Bobby Baker, and he texted me that I made a mistake on the Bobby Baker case. And I said, "Thanks, Jeff. Hope you're doing well too, bud. I'll include it as a rebuttal." No, Jeff's great. Here's what he said. "I believe that you said the FBI took over the investigation, but actually the Senate investigation began in late 63, stopped for a time in 64, and then with additional allegations by Don Reynolds regarding the DC stadium, it was resurrected. The investigation actually lasted almost 18 months into the spring of 65. There were separate investigations conducted by the FBI and the IRS. They may have shared some information, but they were separate and distinct from the Senate hearings on Baker." So basically, I said everything was dropped in April of 64, and Jeff's just given a little more context that, yeah, this dropped by the Senate, but there are still FBI and IRS investigations, and it was still ongoing for a while. So just to clean up the record, and obviously I'm giving Jeff a hard time, but I like Jeff, and I appreciate that feedback from my friend Jeff. Anything else you want to talk about, Don, when it comes to J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI?
I think we got a lot out on it, and your series was great. And on the Bobby Baker stuff, there's a whole other can of worms that if listeners are interested in more on that, besides Jeff's series, which I've also been following, is very well done and very interesting. But the Burt Jenner angle to that whole morass in Fort Worth is something that really blew my mind when I looked into that. So our Jenner Role Dynamics episode has more on that. And then with the, closing thoughts on Hoover, I just see all of these guys as a real game of Russian roulette. I mean, the way that Angleton reportedly on his deathbed said, when you're in a room with these people, I would count Hoover in that as well. He didn't list Hoover, but he was talking about CIA guys, that that you're with a room full of cheats and liars and killers that are rightfully going to end up in hell. And Hoover is certainly among that crowd.
Yeah, and then Angleton said, "I shall see them soon."
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was good. Oliver brought that one out at the committee hearing. All right, well, yeah, hey, we appreciate you coming on. And again, everybody, go check out Fourth Reich Archaeology. They have a lot of good different series. It's called The Warren Commission Decided, and again, the whole podcast is great. I highly recommend it. And I also want to thank you for the kind things you've said about this show on your show. I've listened and I've heard, and every time I'm listening, I go, "Oh, that's very kind. Thank you very much." So, thank you.
Well, thank you again, and thank you for doing the great work and providing a great resource that is accessible to anyone. That's our goal too. And all of this stuff is really the more the better informed you can be to, because I think you and I could agree that in order to get out of the deadlock of a degraded and corrupted political system is going to take a wide range of different ideas. And the one thing that will make it all possible is a common baseline understanding of our history and of what on earth happened that we were so brainwashed and hypnotized into believing these myths that we tell ourselves about the reality that we live in.
Well, yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. And you're one of the most reasonable cartoon characters wearing a hat that I've ever discussed the JFK. All right. Well, hey, okay, Solving JFK listeners, we're gonna have another bonus episode next week. I gotta have a little more time before I put out these LBJ episodes and lose half of my listeners. So looking forward to that, and we'll talk to you guys soon. Thanks a lot.